Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Discover Magazine, the June 2021 edition of Discover Magazine. We're going to start this week with Show Me the Science. Beneath any valuable study, you'll find a web of research, institutions, humans, and of course, money. Trust in science hinges on that process. This is by Anna Funk. Some scientists wish to uncover truths of the natural universe, to learn the properties of distant stars or deep-sea creatures or the interior of our cells. Others seek solutions, hoping to better our lives or undo the damage that we've done to our environment. The list of motivations runs long, depending on who you talk to. But most people do not know any scientists personally. In 2017, about 4 out of 5 Americans polled could not name a single living scientist, and that's according to Research America. Of those who could, top answers were Stephen Hawking, about 27%, who died in 2018, Neil deGrasse Tyson, 19%, who last published research in 2008, and Bill Nye, 5%, who quit his job as an engineer in 1986. Yet 1.5 million plus Americans are currently working as a scientist, which is more than the number of elementary school teachers. We don't know their names because they're mostly behind the scenes, trying to resolve the questions bit by bit. Few will ever do work that makes the news. Even fewer will garner enough publicity that people begin to recognize them. Regular Discover readers may know the names like astrophysicist Avi Loeb or Jennifer Doudna, the 2020 Nobel Prize winner for her work on the CRISPR gene editing. But before we could edit genes with CRISPR, people were accumulating decades of data on microbiology and genetics. Pull any research today out of a hat, we can only speculate how their work might change our lives. Despite their power to improve the world, modern scientists face the realities of polarization and politicalization. Those of us who study science see it as a really unsettling time, says Alan Brandt, a historian of science at Harvard University. We're alarmed at the erosion of scientific legitimacy and authority because it's so crucial to solving the world's problems. Recent history illuminates how strategic corporate interests and politics can undermine science, beginning on a large scale in the 1950s. That's when big tobacco began sowing seeds of doubt with tactics that many industries will still use today. Shortcomings in academia and medicine have also harmed public trust, such as the rare incidents of fraud and the many ways that racial, gender, and other biases have informed research and public health. Those blunders have especially hurt women, people of color, the black and indigenous communities, and the LGBTQ+ people. In 2020, fractured trust ruptured into a public health disaster as scores of Americans revealed that they believed the COVID-19 pandemic was either a hoax or purposefully and drastically exaggerated for political gain, despite the constant assertions to the contrary from health officials, doctors, and researchers. You listen to scientists and you might hear that climate change could be mitigated, vaccines save lives, or genetically engineered crops can help combat starvation without adverse health effects. Why should we believe them? The only answer can come from an examination of the process of science itself, which unfolds along a web of funding, research standards, and public perceptions. Behind the curtain, Carlos Mascascal, a philosopher of science at the University of Nevada, Reno, thinks a big part of science's public perception problem is poor communication. We haven't done a good enough job of bringing people behind the scenes to the process of science, as opposed to the product of science, says Mascascal. Take nutrition science and eggs. If you just read the headlines, you think eggs were a staple food one day, a cholesterol-filled death trap the next, and then back to being a healthy option before you even had a chance to find a new favorite breakfast. If you look deeper, Mascascal explains, what looked like a flip-flop on the surface was really just scientists doing their best, learning. When researchers identified the cholesterol's role in heart disease and cholesterol's high level in eggs, they warned people to be cautious about their egg consumption. Then they discovered that there are two types of cholesterol, and eggs have a healthier kind. Eggs went back on the menu. I think that it's genuinely one of the most impressive and one of the best features of science, says Mariscal. When it goes wrong, it fixes itself. It can correct itself. Researchers are constantly following up on what current evidence suggests is true and pushing the boundaries of what's known. The field is designed to both challenge our current understanding and wade into the questions that have no solid answers. Well, at least not yet. The formal process of science typically begins when a researcher thinks of a specific, testable question and then seeks to answer it, typically with a team of experts. The approach goes through multiple reviews, approvals, and often failed attempts to secure the funding. We'll tumble down that mystery money hole later. The question may get tweaked along the way, and the research involves animals or humans to subject themselves to an additional review board and committee. If money is secured, the lab or the fieldwork begins, and the team documents their findings. When it's time to share them with the world, they write a research paper and select a scientific journal that might publish it. Options include many smaller subject matter specific journals and some bigger names such as Science or Nature. That's when the critical peer review phase kicks in. After submission to a specific journal, the main editor will give a paper first look. If it seems to be a good fit, that editor will identify typically three other scientists in the relevant field of research, those eponymous peers in the process, and ask them to review that paper. That means multiple experts will examine the work ultra carefully, looking for anything that seems amiss. They might say, "I think this data point is a glitch, you used the wrong analysis here," or, "Your results are fine, but the conclusions you draw are flawed." Any given paper goes through at least one round of edits between the number of authors and the number of reviewers, typically more, until everyone involved agrees that the paper is sound. This thorough vetting and scrutiny is the reason that peer-reviewed journals form the bedrock of solid science. Paper trail. Money, too, is embedded in this foundation, a reality that can draw criticism and scrutiny. If you want research, you need funding. So who's forking it over? Simply put, research and development, or R&D, is funded by numerous businesses, organizations, and government bodies. While nailing down the figures gets sticky, and it depends on how you define science research, $580 billion was invested in R&D in the United States in 2018, and that's according to the National Center for Science and Engineering Statistics. Barring more than half of that spent on experimental development, which includes a lot of private R&D, such as an auto company improving their car engines, that never lands in journals or public view. Roughly about $211.5 billion went towards basic and applied science research. From that total, businesses contributed about 43% of the funds. The rest came from federal money, 38%, plus state government, nonprofits, and other institutions. The bulk of the federal science funding gets dispersed as grants to universities and institutions through the National Science Foundation, or the NSF, the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, and other agencies. An agency like the NSF, a panel made up of external people, experts in the relative fields, reviews each proposal and makes a recommendation for which the projects get funding. Typically, the granting body is not involved with the research once it begins. Scientists remain independent to do their work, but share a few progress reports to the funding institution along the way. People think that if someone is funding something, then they're basically buying that research and the people doing the research, and that's not quite the case, says Antoinette Serrato, a climatologist at the University of Nevada at Reno. Things can, however, get a bit complicated when for-profit industries invest considerable money into research, and that's according to Mariscal. Definitely, in the majority of cases, the funding has little to do with any noticeable effect, he says. But you have these really malicious use of funding, as to the tobacco industry, that went out of their way to fund lots of research, he says. For instance, the tobacco industry invested in research about the genetic factors of lung disease. They also built legal cases around asbestos to fend off patients who smoked and got cancer. None of that means the research itself was conducted improperly, even if the motivation for and use of the research was shady. They just wanted to muddy up the water, says Mariscal. Essentially, research could be used like a shield to protect the tobacco sales. Tobacco industry playbook. Even when funding sources aren't directly participating in the research process, they do have one ability that gives them power: choosing what to fund. This was a core strategy of the tobacco industry's disinformation campaign that lasted for half of the last century. They funded scientists to study other causes of cancer besides tobacco, and more. It's a pretty dramatic story, says Brandt, the science historian. Top tobacco company executives gathered at New York's Plaza Hotel in December of 1953. It was a crisis moment for them, with major findings beginning to connect the dots between smoking and lung cancer. So they called in a public relations expert, John Hill, the head of one of the biggest PR firms at the time. Hill basically said to them, "Do not try to dispute this. Do not ignore it. If you don't like the science that's coming out, produce your own science." And so the industry set up an industry research program, says Brandt. The strategy had come to be known as the Tobacco Industry Playbook. Others, like the oil and beverage industries, have followed suit. The main goal? Fund as much research as possible that distracts from your harmful product, as well as other research that might demonstrate your product is safe. That way it could point to the other research and say that the link is between the product and the harm is not clear. In 1981, just a few years after Exxon, scientists found a convincing link between fossil fuels and climate change. Company executive Roger Cohen wrote an internal memo warning that the continued consumption of fossil fuels could be catastrophic, at least for the substantial fraction of the population. Yet, external communications from the company maintained a different message. Even years later, then-chief executive Lee Raymond said in a 1996 speech at the Detroit Economic Club, he said, "Currently, the scientific evidence is inconclusive as to whether human activities are having a significant effect on a global climate." Unquote. Today, this type of messaging is still the bread and butter of oil and other lobbyists and can be repeated by U.S. politicians and PR consultants alike. In some instances, campaigns have realized that simply saying the evidence is inconclusive is enough to achieve their goals without actually funding or presenting any research. Responsible research. These tactics can complicate the playing field when it comes to individual pieces of research. But the long-term trajectory of science has ways of sifting out and correcting work that is infected by ulterior motives or human error. There are ways to identify corporate interests, especially in modern work. Most scientific journals require authors to disclose any conflicts of interest and their funding sources before publishing any results. Anyone reading scientific findings can look for a disclaimer, usually at the bottom of a paper, before the work is cited. And although it may seem that researchers are incentivized to falsify their work, the incentives to not conduct research fraud can be much stronger. Researchers caught conducting unethical research can lose their jobs and be blacklisted from the field. In 2005, a professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Vermont was the first American researcher to go to jail for falsifying data, and he was not the last. Since 2009, the NSF, through federal law, requires that all institutes that receive NSF funding mandate responsible conduct of research training for their researchers. It's like driver's ed or sex ed, but for scientists, complete with dramatized videos depicting the consequences of any unethical practices. Sometimes scientists do make an honest mistake that slips through, like misidentifying an insect specimen, failing to notice the cat walking across the keyboard and changing a number, or choosing the wrong model to analyze their data. If a researcher down the line notices the error, the paper can be retracted, essentially unpublished. Or future studies can show why something was wrong and the earlier paper becomes obsolete, even if it was published. This is one reason why research is an ongoing, cumulative process. One bad study will not typically cause significant harm. There are some times when there's stuff that gets done that gets overturned. That's fine. It's what we expect, says Mariscal. Ultimately, the whole process is designed to ensure that science unfolds ethically and accurately, But science also doesn't happen in a vacuum. The impact it has on the world rests not only on human scientists, but on the interplay between the policymakers, the media, and society. Communicating findings through this tangle of opinions and channels complicates the matters drastically. Journalists at Discover and other publications play a role in this chain, poring over science journals, parsing compelling findings, and talking to researchers. Distilling all the information and discerning what the public needs and wants to know is more art than science. Some days the news is, study says eggs are back on the menu. Other days science communication is explaining the arrival and the approval of a vaccine that was created in record time and poised to save countless lives around the globe. Academia and industry and government can produce effective, excellent science for the human good, says Brandt, pointing out humanity's current hope against COVID-19. In that sense, the same global pandemic that has fueled rampant misinformation and revealed the extent of some people's distrust also offers a striking example of science and its process working properly. Anna Funk, the writer of this article, is an ecologist and science writer who is based in Kansas City, Missouri. We do have some side articles here. Who's paying the scientists? In 2018, $580 billion was spent on science research and development, R&D, in the United States, compared to $548 million in 2017. This includes the categories of experimental development and basic and applied research. The vast majority of development funding, 85% or $314 billion in 2018, came from businesses. Much of that work is prioritary for products, goods, and processes. A total of $211.5 billion went towards basic and applied research. From that total, businesses contributed about 43%, federal money funded 38%, and state governments, nonprofits, and higher education institutions invested 19%. A Skeptic's Guide to Reading Science is another side article. With so much misinformation drifting around us, it could be hard to tell what's real and what's bunk. When it comes to scientific research, here are six questions that can help you decide when to trust a study's claim and when to remain skeptical. Question number one, is this info peer-reviewed? All papers are not created equal, even if they run in a bona fide journal. Sometimes you can find preprint papers that haven't been fully vetted. Letters from experts or editors are also appearing in journals. Examine the language at the top and the bottom of the papers to understand what you're looking at. Number two, who did the study? On any scientific paper, you'll find a list of authors and their institutional affiliations. Look for trusted universities and institutes. Take note if the researchers work for a for-profit industry or a nonprofit with a policy agenda. This information is typically right underneath the author's name at the top of a paper, sometimes hidden in a drop-down menu. If it's not there, it might be tucked away at the end of the paper somewhere. Number three, who funded the study? Research rarely gets published anymore without a disclosure about research funds. Look for federal agencies like the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health. Notice that the funding came from a for-profit industry or a nonprofit with a policy agenda. Look for a funding disclosure and a conflict of interest statement near the acknowledgement section of the end of the paper. Number four, what were the parameters? Consider whether test subjects in studies were animals or humans. Sample size is also a critical component. If you want to know if a new drug is safe, would you be satisfied with results on just one person? Or 100 mice, or 100,000 people. Although different types of studies require differing sample sizes to get satisfactory results, trust your gut when a number seems low. Look at the methods section of the paper to see the sample size. It's often explicitly stated with the number N, such as N equals 100. Number five, do the results support the conclusions? There are a lot of reasons why researchers occasionally write a paper where the results do not exactly support the written conclusions, and they're not all malicious. But this is a key distinction that can separate good studies from bad. be wary of conclusions and claims that exaggerate the actual findings or go beyond the scope of the data that's been collected in the study. This one requires such expertise or practice, as well as a thorough look through the whole paper. And lastly, number six, do other studies agree? Finally, any single study is just that, one study, typically in a vast field of similar work. Before a research finding starts to be accepted as a possible fact, countless other studies need to confirm it or try to disprove it. Although you might be able to find a few studies that claim carbon emissions from humans does not cause climate change, that would not negate the thousands of others that shows the opposite. Whenever deciding what to believe, look at how many studies are possible. What does the larger body of evidence as a whole suggest? The best shortcut to this is a review paper or what's called a meta-analysis. These are papers written by experts that summarize numerous studies and all the findings on a subject to date. Now let's head over to hot science. Do we really need to protect every species? Focus on individuals or entire ecosystems. Scientists disagree. The extinctions of species occurred long before humans arrived on the Earth. By that definition, it's a natural process. But today, extinctions are increasing rapidly and very often linked to human activities. Take the Bramble K. melamese, a small rodent on a remote island that's uninhabited by humans. In 2016, it became the first mammal to be erased from the planet due to climate change. Some conservationists mourned, but others questioned whether every extinction is something to be worried about. In the face of tough decisions about human lifestyles and the climate crisis, a split among scientists is surfacing. Losing one species may not change life as we know it, so perhaps our limited conservation resources should focus on preserving the biodiversity in those systems where it benefits the humans. Sometimes, such as when dense forests prevent landslides, a great diversity of species isn't needed to perform this function. Essentially, we may ask the question, how should we value life? The claim protects the ecosystem, not the species. For Dr. Peter Caravera, the president and CEO of the Aquarium of the Pacific, the term biodiversity crisis wrongly inflates the role of individual non-human species in human well-being and prosperity, when in reality, holistic ecosystems are more important. A marshland that stifles the tidal waves may not need 16 different species of shellfish to hold it all together. It's a dramatic extrapolation, he says, to conclude that the extinction of one species would imperil the coastline and thus human well-being. Peter adheres to a metaphor developed by biologist Paul Ehrlich. Nature is like an airplane, and species are the rivets that hold it all together. Without a few rivets, a plane could still fly, but if you take too many out, the plane will fall apart and crash. The trouble is, he says, we don't know how many rivets we can take out. Instead of trying to nail down that number, we would be better served focusing on the ecosystem's function, that is, keeping the plane in the sky rather than saving every rivet. The first question you ask is, if this species goes functionally extinct, what will be different about the world? A scientist's role, he says, should be to answer that question as the evidence society uses to decide whether a species needs to be saved. Some conversation biologists, however, have turned into activists, when instead it's up to society to weigh the social and cultural values against what it would take to protect a species. Often that means deciding whether to spend hard-to-find money in conservation or elsewhere. The counterpoint, morals matter. Tierra Curry is both a scientist and an activist with the Center for Biological Diversity, and she's well acquainted with the nonprofit Cash Crunch. Sometimes she feels pushed to concentrate efforts on protecting a more famous species, like the monarch butterfly, rather than the seemingly mundane freshwater mussels in the art that line her walls. A focus on preserving ecosystem services can often bolster financial support, but for her, allowing a species to go extinct is wrong. The funding exists for conservation, but we choose not to use it. Extinction is a political choice, she says. We only have $100 million. What can we save? That's not the question. The question is, how do we get $1 billion? valuing the natural world in terms of how each individual species benefits the humans may be too narrow a view, says Curry. We're not always looking at the right metrics. For instance, genetic diversity can make the ecosystems resilient in the face of drastic changes like climate change and disease, she notes. A single invasive species may replace native species and accomplish an ecosystem function in the short term, but a disease would more easily wipe it out in the future. Diversity also brings honest allure, Curry says. It's the box of 128 crayons versus the box of 8 crayons. No kid wants the box of 8 on the first day of school when they could have had the box of 128 crayons. Curry's main motivation, however, is morality. Mass global extinctions have happened 5 times before, but humans have the capacity to understand that we are causing this one. Because we know, she says, I think we have the moral responsibility to take care of our fellow Earthlings. I think we have time for one more. The search goes on. New particle accelerator data from the T2K experiment could finally tell us where all the antimatter went. In 1996, Discover reported on a new experiment that would probe the far universe for signs of antimatter. These particles are theoretically identical in behavior to the ones that we know, but with opposing electrical charges, among other differences. The physicists' theory about the Big Bang say there should be an equal amount of matter and antimatter created during an event. But we live in a universe full of matter with little antimatter in sight. There are different explanations for this, including that all of the antimatter might just be too far away to see. The search for distant anti-stars and anti-galaxies was the focus of our April 1996 article, The Antimatter Mission, which chronicled the genesis of an experiment called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, the AMS. The experiment set out to measure cosmic rays to see if any of them came from antimatter. The AMS has been running on the International Space Station since 2011, but has yet to turn up much evidence for anti-galaxies and the like. It could be that our universe is largely empty of antimatter, which poses another question: where did it all go? Scientists have posited long that slight differences in how matter and antimatter behave could have led matter to win out in the moments after the Big Bang. But findings of these asymmetries have proved difficult. Now physicists with Japan's T2K experiment have published data that moves us closer to an answer. The T2K scientists are tracking a curious property of neutrinos, hard-to-detect particles that rarely interact with matter. The neutrinos change type or flavor as they travel. For example, muon neutrinos might turn into electron neutrinos. The T2K experiment has been watching how both regular neutrinos and antineutrinos oscillate between the flavors, and they've noticed that there's a slight disparity in how they behave. The transition of a muon neutrino to an electron neutrino happens at a higher rate than that of a muon antineutrino to an electron antineutrino, and that's according to Mark Hartz, a particle physicist at Canada's York University and co-author of a recent Nature paper on the T2K data. The data provides further evidence that there could be some slight asymmetries between normal matter and antimatter, perhaps enough to explain why the universe today is almost exclusively made of matter. But Nobel laureate Samuel Ting, the principal investigator of the AMS experiment, says we need more data to say whether or not antimatter isn't out there somewhere. This neutrino experiment only says from Earth we observe in space more matter than antimatter. It does not say antimatter has disappeared. Ting's views may not represent the majority opinion among scientists, but the physicist is undaunted. If you don't look, then really you will never know, he says. Well, that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from Discover Magazine, the June 2021 edition of Discover Magazine. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.